Good morning, all. The case for argument this morning, St. Pierre versus Wall. Mr. Warner.
Good morning. May it please the court, Scott Warner, on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Robert St. Pierre. Also seated with me at council table is Scott Stein.
Mr. Stein?
As this court knows, the district court has determined that Mr. St. Pierre was denied the effective assistance of counsel at the sentencing phase of his state court proceedings, and the state does not challenge this ruling in this appeal. In so finding, the district court made several findings that have direct application to this appeal with respect to Mr. St. Pierre's claim of ineffective assistance at the guilt phase. For example, the district court found that trial counsel's so-called investigation into Mr. St. Pierre's mental condition was, quote, so cursory, so perfunctory, that it can hardly be called an investigation at all. In addition, the court also found that trial counsel's investigation into St. Pierre's mental health was, quote, unreasonable because it terminated after Monty Williams, who was an unlicensed psychologist who revealed a complete lack of understanding with respect to the legal standard for insanity.
Mr. Warner, I wonder if you could clarify a factual aspect of this record for me, because what I want to focus on, you know, eventually is Mr. St. Pierre's guilty plea and the points that you've raised about whether he was aware of the circumstances that he needed to be aware of. There's a statement in Judge Kokoris's opinion that appears on page 26 in the appendix to your brief. It's in the second paragraph, and Judge Kokoris says, the possibility of an insanity defense was raised and discussed. And I understood him to be saying that it was raised and discussed in conjunction with the guilty plea. Can you shed any light on that for me?
It's my understanding, Your Honor, based on the record, that in fact the parameters of the insanity defense as it existed under the law at the time, at the time of the offenses, was an issue not discussed with Mr. St. Pierre during the guilty plea proceedings.
But do you mean prior to the guilty plea or even during the phase when he was, you know, as we know with the flipping and flopping, but, you know, when he was perhaps trying to withdraw the guilty plea? At
yes.
What point in time are we talking about?
I believe the issue of insanity was first raised in between the time of Mr. St. Pierre's first motion to withdraw the guilty plea, which was submitted the day after Mr. St. Pierre pled guilty.
Right.
And at that time, Mr. Barassa, St. Pierre's trial counsel, had knowledge that Mr. St. Pierre committed suicide. That was
tried to commit suicide.
We wouldn't be here if you had been successful.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Your Honor. I apologize for misspeaking. And it was not until sometime prior to the commencement of the mitigation hearing, which began on September 12th, that Mr. Barassa brought to the trial court's attention the fact that he had had a discussion with Mr. Williams from Menard Correctional Center, during which time Mr. Williams stated that there was a very, very strong probability or words to that effect that Mr. St. Pierre may have been insane at the time of the crime.
That was before the court accepted the plea?
That was after the court accepted the plea. As I understand it, I don't see any indication in the record that prior to the time that Mr. St. Pierre entered his plea of guilty, which was, I believe, on August 8, 1988. I don't know of any indication in the record that Mr. Barassa discussed the issue of insanity with Mr. St. Pierre.
Okay, thank you.
Several of the other district court's findings with respect to Mr. Barassa's performance at the sentencing hearing have direct applicability here. For example, the district court also found that Mr. Barassa failed to pursue the many other obvious avenues that presented themselves, such as issuing what we've been referring to as garden variety subpoenas that would have led to the discovery of a whole host of documentary evidence that established Mr. St. Pierre's long and troubled mental history. Had Barassa uncovered those records and presented them, that would have assisted Mr. St. Pierre in making a knowing and intelligent decision with respect to whether he wanted to plead guilty or pursue an insanity defense.
But let me ask you another question here. This is also continuing with the district court, that is to say Judge Kokoris's decision that however poorly Mr. Barassa may have performed, that Mr. St. Pierre was so bound and determined to plead guilty that there was no prejudice in the sense that we use the term for Strickland. And what I'm trying to understand at this point is, to what extent is your argument simply one about Mr. St. Pierre not having received the information about what the status in 1982 was of the Illinois Insanity Defense? And to what extent is it that it couldn't have been a voluntary decision about the guilty plea sliding over into Mr. St. Pierre's mental incompetence? I don't understand you to be saying he was mentally incompetent to plead.
No, that's right. That is not our position. We're not raising that issue in this appeal. Our central argument is that Mr. St. Pierre did not have adequate information based on Mr. Barras's failures to uncover a host of documentary evidence, failure to retain a qualified independent mental health expert who could have expressed an opinion regarding Mr. St. Pierre's sanity at the time of the crime, and also his failure to explain the legal parameters of the insanity defense as it existed at the time of the offenses in this case.
And so basically, just to clarify, you're saying that the district court's speculation that St. Pierre wouldn't have changed his mind if somebody had given him this information isn't supported somehow.
That's correct, and I think there are three main reasons why that finding or conclusion is not supported. One, when this case was remanded after Mr. St. Pierre's convictions were reversed for the first time on appeal, Mr. St. Pierre basically felt like he had no hope. He had no defense other than insanity. And second, we have Mr. St. Pierre's affidavit, which is in the record and it's cited in our brief. Neither the state nor the district court raises that affidavit, and I think based on that affidavit, there is at least a reasonable probability that had he been provided with full and adequate information, and had Mr. Barras explained to him the parameters of the insanity defense as it existed in 1982, that he would have withdrawn his plea of guilty, he would have persisted in pursuing perhaps a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. And to the extent that there may be some argument with respect to the validity of that particular affidavit, I think there's evidence in the record that establishes Mr. St. Pierre's pattern of behavior in terms of changing his mind, particularly after he receives additional information. The instance I'd like to mention in particular has to do with Mr. St. Pierre's desire to pursue a full mitigation hearing. As you may recall, at the commencement of the mitigation hearing or during the aggravation phase, Mr. St. Pierre was adamant about not pursuing a mitigation hearing at all. He just wanted to get the proceedings over with as soon as he could. However, Judge Neville, rightly so, insisted that he take a little more time to think about it. And when Mr. Barassa presented him with the statement from Mr. Williams that there was a very strong probability or a probability that he was insane at the time of the offenses, Mr. St. Pierre changed his mind and he decided to proceed with a full mitigation hearing. So I think there's plenty of evidence in the record to establish that Mr. St. Pierre, had he been provided with full and adequate information, would not have pled guilty, and he would have pursued.
Mr. Warner, let me see if I understand your position. After the reversal and remand, you're suggesting that because of the situation he found himself in, that is Mr. St. Pierre, it was the obligation of counsel to raise with him the insanity defense? Is there anything based in what transpired to that point which would constitutionally compel a counsel to raise it?
I think there are several things that should have led Mr. Barassa to discuss an insanity defense and investigate it further. One was the mere fact that Mr. St. Pierre was going to enter a blind plea of guilty after his conviction was reversed. That caught the attention of the trial court and Mr. Barassa, rightly so. It's not just limited to that, however. By the time Mr. Barassa filed the first motion to withdraw the guilty plea, the very day after Mr. St. Pierre pled guilty, that motion was in part based on a suicide attempt that had occurred shortly before the time that
which
he entered.
Which is usually the most sincere form of self-criticism. If I understand correctly, the defendant insisted that he wanted to plead guilty because he didn't want to get away with murder, a conscience response as opposed to an insanity. People who plead guilty are not necessarily insane, are they?
No, not in all instances.
Even if they do it blind?
That's correct. Not in all
instances. Even if they do it after the cases have been reversed?
That's right. Not in all instances. However, in addition to Mr. St. Pierre's decision to plead guilty and the fact that he had committed suicide, Mr. Brasa himself...
Well, he didn't. He attempted suicide.
He attempted suicide.
Hang on to that one carefully.
That. I still do have a client. He attempted suicide, rather.
Just let me stop you there. You keep referring to in addition to pleading guilty. Now, are we to take that decision to plead guilty after the remand, just as a standalone factor before you expand on the others, we should consider that as an indication to a counsel? See, I want to understand the position of what any counsel should face
sure.
in a remand where, put aside the suicide attempt for a second, I don't mean to minimize that as a factor, perhaps, but you want to build on the fact of just a plea?
I want to build on that fact. Our position is not that that fact alone creates an obligation on the part of counsel to investigate an insanity defense. I don't think that's the law. I think the law is pretty clear that there is no general obligation on the part of defense counsel to investigate and raise an insanity plea in every case, and that's not our position here. But when you consider the circumstances, the totality of the circumstances, we do feel that increased the level of obligation on Mr. Barasa's part. Mr. Barasa himself even acknowledged a professional obligation to explore the defense of insanity. He had a statement from Mr. Williams, despite the fact that Mr. Williams was later found not to be competent to testify on the issue of insanity. Mr. Williams did say that there was a very good chance that Mr. St. Pierre was insane at the time of the crime, and it's our position that that created an obligation on Mr. Brasa's part to look further, to dig further.
When did he get that statement from Mr. Williams?
That was, I believe the record reflects that occurred at some point between the time that Mr. St. Pierre entered his plea of guilty and the time that the sentencing hearing began in September 12th.
That September 12th hearing.
Exactly.
Somewhere between the 8th of August and the 12th.
Exactly. That's what the record reflects. And in addition, at the first sanity hearing, if we can call it that, on September 12th, at the beginning of the sentencing hearing, Judge Neville even told Mr. Barasa that it was the obligation of the defense to raise the issue of insanity to a level which deserved further inquiry. Barasa utterly failed in that regard, and I think the district court's opinion sets out those findings quite clearly.
Are you making a broader argument that before the guilty plea, Mr. Barasa should have collected available records about, I mean, forget about insanity for the moment, even for any other purpose, available records about Mr. St. Pierre's past, his Maryville Academy records or his Menard records?
As I understand it, there were some discussions between Mr. Barasa and Mr. St. Pierre about some of the places where he had been in the past. And if Mr. Barasa had information about where Mr. St. Pierre may have spent time as a youth, where he may have been in a youth home or something like that, I certainly believe that should have triggered an obligation on Mr. Barasa's part to get those records. It may have led to something it may not have. In this instance, very clearly it did. Those records described a consistent pattern of troubling behavior on Mr. St. Pierre's part, and they could have been very helpful, as we found in Dr. Hemrick's report. Dr. Hemrick is the only qualified mental health expert who has expressed an opinion regarding Mr. St. Pierre's sanity at the time of the crimes based on a full review of the documentary evidence that was readily available to Mr. Barasa, indeed, through garden variety subpoenas that post-conviction counsel have issued in this case. In addition, Mr. St. Pierre's now three-time diagnosed bipolar disorder would have also been a factor that would have weighed in terms of whether or not there's a reasonable probability that the state would not have been able to prove Mr. St. Pierre sane beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's the standard. Dr. Stipe's finding to the contrary in 1989 is really of no moment here, because that finding was not based on a review of any of the documentary evidence that is now available, and basically he was dealing with incomplete information due in large part to Mr. St. Pierre's trial counsel's failures to investigate adequately the factual underpinnings.
A minute ago, the standard for, or I should say the 1982 standard in Illinois
yes.
for an insanity defense, to what extent are you basing your argument on the fact that Judge Kokoris says insanity wasn't part of the case?
Yes, we are absolutely basing both our prejudice argument in connection with the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and also with respect to our claim that Mr. St. Pierre's guilty plea was not knowing and voluntary on that. That is a clear error of law. The trial court cites the 1998 case, People v. Cundiff, which applied the insanity provision in effect as of the time the crimes in that case were committed, which was in 1998. And the law is very clear that in 1998, the burden remained with the defendant to prove insanity by clear and convincing evidence. And the law is very clear that the law applicable to Mr. St. Pierre's claims in this case, the law in effect in 1982, provided that as long as the defendant raised some evidence of insanity, the burden then shifted to the state to prove Mr. St. Pierre sane beyond a reasonable doubt.
So in 1982, just to absolutely be clear about this, there was an initial burden of production on the defendant to put before a trial court the some evidence or whatever it was.
That's correct.
Calling into question. So there was no general obligation to look into sanity in all cases, but when the defendant satisfied that burden of production, the burden then shifted to the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's exactly right. That's paragraph 3-2 in chapter 38 of the Illinois Revised Statutes. That was the standard, and that's a point that the district court simply got wrong.
And it would violate the ex post facto clause.
That's correct.
To apply,
it was to apply any different law.
Sure. Yeah.
Correct. The case, I would direct the court's attention to the case of Prophet v. Waldron. It's a Fifth Circuit case in which the Fifth Circuit found that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to investigate an insanity plea. And in that case, a similar burden-shifting statute was in effect and applicable to the claims at issue in that case. And the court found
that... It isn't really a burden-shifting. It's a raising question. The question doesn't shift any burden. The defendant has no burden at all, except there has to be a reasonable doubt as to the sanity.
That's right. The initial...
But that's a burden of production, not a burden of persuasion. And a burden of proof is one of persuasion, not of production.
That's right. As I understand it, Mr.
Thanks.
Okay. Yes, that's right. The burden, the court in Prophet v. Waldron found, and I'm using the Fifth Circuit's language, that the burden-shifting statute in that case was central to its prejudice inquiry. It was central to its finding of prejudice. And I would submit that a similar result is required here under the facts that we have. In addition, counsel's failures also mean that Mr. St. Pierre's guilty plea was not knowing, intelligent, or voluntary as required under the Constitution. It had to be an informed choice among alternatives. Mr. St. Pierre did not have completed...
Assuming that they had investigated and checked on the background at schools and so on, what indication was there other than the fact that he was antisocial to indicate he was insane in the legal sense, because it is a legal term, not a medical one?
Sure. The record, it's our position that those records...
Yeah, when I ask what record, what in the record indicates he was... So far off the grab, he didn't understand things.
Several statements, and while the records themselves may have not been enough to establish that Mr. St. Pierre was legally insane, certainly...
Oh, no, what would raise an issue as to the legal insanity?
Sure, there are several statements in these records that Mr. St. Pierre was hyperactive, he had a tendency to engage in destructive behavior after undergoing psychological testing. He had problems with anxiety, anger, hostility, and frustration.
He described about a third of the human race, but go ahead.
He tended to engage in uncontrolled destructive behavior, aggressive and senseless acts. It is not our position that the statements in these records alone would establish that Mr. St. Pierre was legally insane.
No, I say, is there anything in that that would indicate insanity? And that's the point you're raising. If you look into those things, you think this raises sufficient issues,
yes,
so we can now go and say this man is destructive and generally speaking, is a lousy kid, and we should look into something further because it's an indication of insanity.
Yeah, I think all the statements...
You think that's an indication of insanity?
That is an indication, at the very least, that trial counsel should inquire further. Take these records to a qualified mental health expert and have Mr. St. Pierre examined, particularly in the circumstances of this case, where St. Pierre did not have any other defense available. There were these indications. There were indications based on Mr. St. Pierre's decision to enter a blind plea of guilty, his suicide attempt. Taking all those circumstances into account, these records, if used properly, should have at the very least triggered Mr. Barassa to investigate further, to have Mr. St. Pierre examined by an independent mental health expert. And at
refresh
that
my point, recollection, when was the suicide attempt?
It was shortly before Mr. St. Pierre entered his plea of guilty. And Mr. Barraza raised that the very day after Mr. St. Pierre entered his guilty plea in a motion to withdraw that guilty plea.
But nobody told Judge Neville about it on the day of the guilty plea?
It was not raised on the very day of the guilty plea.
Even though it had already happened?
Yes, and I'm not sure if Mr. Barraza even knew it happened before August 8th, the day on which the guilty plea was entered, but he certainly knew about it by the next day because it showed up in a written motion that Mr. Barraza submitted to the court.
Mr. Warner, do you think our circumstance is at all affected by the fact that we had the proceedings before, that is, the trial and the remand, does that speak to what the counsel may have relied upon as far as the track record in this case? I mean, he didn't walk out of the bullpen prepared to pick a jury
right.
initially.
Right.
We have a case with a pretty substantial history, and it's hard to spot in the earlier opinions of the state high court anything that would hint at this 82 situation. I know.
Right. I guess I would respond to that is that certainly I think Mr. St. Pierre's prior experience with the criminal justice system may have gone more to the issue of whether he was competent to plead guilty, had an understanding of the proceedings, but I do think that in light of...
Could he relied on that maybe this matter had been reflected upon at the time of the original trial?
I don't think there's anything in the record to say that we can draw that inference. I think the
so evidence... the facts of the case, you know, you suggest that what else is there in light of the
sure.
original guilty finding, it might well strike with the array of facts against this defendant in this case that might have been an issue reflected upon by counsel originally.
Yeah, I guess in terms of factual innocence, maybe that affected that inquiry, but here where we had Barraza in interacting with Mr. St. Pierre and had knowledge of the suicide attempt and other factors, that it was the obligation of Mr. Barraza to conduct an investigation in this instance.
Yeah, but that doesn't that speak to that time then, in other words, speaking to the entering of a plea then, not so much speaking to, in other words, if counsel is confronted, as Mr. Barraza was, with the phenomenon of Mr. St. Pierre's decision before Judge Neville, I mean, I can understand that triggering the kinds of concerns you're speaking about. But should it relate back, I guess, so many years at that point?
I guess I would look at Mr. Barraza's obligations under the facts and circumstances that he was presented with at the time of the guilty plea. And I think the district court's findings with respect to all the deficiencies in Mr. Barraza's performance certainly indicate an obligation on Mr. Barraza's part to investigate further and pursue that only possible defense that was available.
Well, but theoretically, you can have the lack of effective assistance counsel in the mitigation situation and not have the other. You would acknowledge
Of course.
I mean,
I'm not
suggesting you're trying to slop it over
yeah.
inappropriately. I mean,
no.
If it washes and creates a problem for the other, then it does.
No, that's right. I think in this instance, the deficiencies in the performance in the sentencing proceedings relate directly to
would
the deficiencies.
Would you say that because Judge Neville acted, I believe, most appropriately in delaying, that should have triggered upon Mr. Barraza greater, I mean, should he have taken the lead from the court? Is that
he had plenty of time to investigate an insanity defense, and indeed, at the time that the court denied Mr. St. Pierre's first motion for a sanity hearing, Judge Neville told Mr. Barraza that he had an obligation to raise it to a level that deserve further inquiry.
Yeah, but
even when he,
excuse me. Do you think that Judge Neville was speaking to the insanity or the competency rather than insanity? Do you think his unease, as you read the transcript, spoke to what's going on right before him, not what was the situation at the time of the murders?
Well, Judge Neville,
maybe you can't tell, or maybe he was referring to both.
I think there's an indication that he was concerned with insanity because there's a direct. There's direct language in the transcript which says that it's the obligation of the defense to raise the issue of insanity to an appropriate level. And after all, Judge Neville was considering a motion to determine St. Pierre's sanity at the time of the offense.
Yeah, that I appreciate that. I mean, maybe I'm bifurcating something that shouldn't, but I'm just trying to get a sense of the way you read the record, whether Judge Neville's focus spoke to the entry of the plea or to a possible defense to the crime.
There's no clear indication, but I'd say that a fair reading of the record supports the interpretation that he was talking about insanity at the time of the crime. I see I'm in my time for rebuttal. I'm happy to answer more questions.
Okay, we'll save those for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Warner. Mr. Fitzgerald?
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is James Fitzgerald, Assistant State's Attorney on behalf of the respondent. I happen to have my 1982 Chapter 38. I've gone to it all after all these years. In answer to Judge Wood, you asked about a possible plea. In 1982, a defendant was allowed to plead guilty, not guilty, or guilty but mentally ill. Those are the three pleas. It's Section 113-4. In the affirmative defense, unless raised in the state's case, then the defendant would have to bring in some evidence of that affirmative defense. And then the state would have the burden of disproving that affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay. The quarrel was always with what constituted some evidence. I
mean, in the appellate court, just in the Supreme Court, that was what was
involved. Well, in any case, it was always the question of the quantum of what was put in. The fact that he fell out of his crib or his high chair when he was 4 years old, landed his head, and his mother said he didn't act right after that was not sufficient, although it was that specific one was raised several times.
It has been raised in many of the death penalties I worked on in Illinois that because of one particular act or bad environment that the person grew up in, that automatically translated into an insanity defense. Most courts rejected that in Illinois.
That doesn't seem to be Judge Kokoris's view of this case. I understood Judge Kokoris to be saying that even if there had been, let's say, a full discussion between Mr. Barassa and Mr. St. Pierre before the guilty plea about this possibility for him, and we'll hypothesize that Mr. Barassa had read, you know, all the Maryville records and all the Menard records and all the things, and maybe had hired some psychiatrist to examine Mr. St. Pierre. I understand Judge Kokoris is saying there's no way that Mr. St. Pierre would have chosen not to plead guilty even in the face of all of that. And, of course, if that's true, then the absence of all of those things wouldn't amount to prejudice as far as Strickland is concerned. If there's some reason to question that, then we have a more difficult case.
Well, in answer to that, Your Honor, number one, my friends on the other side depend greatly upon Mr. St. Pierre's self-serving affidavit executed many years after.
What's so self-serving about it?
Well,
the first two-thirds of the affidavit, he completely gives away the opportunity this court gave him to pursue count 7 of his habeas petition, and goes on at great length about how he understood perfectly well how the one juror rule operated, and then he has these last couple of paragraphs. It didn't strike me as what we usually think of as a self-serving affidavit.
Well, at the tail end where he talks about I wouldn't have pled guilty.
Right,
I
but taken as a whole, it's a peculiar document.
I don't know if we were, according to this court's first opinion, if we were to even look at any of his affidavits from now on. Or
well, that's another issue, but it was a peculiar thing to read, I will say.
I would agree, Your Honor. I think what might be confusing here is the question of what he's saying at the time of the crimes and the mitigating factor under 9-1C,
but could we trace through how we get to that? Because I think Judge Flom is getting at the same problem. There are really two layers here. One layer is, was he informed enough about the possibility of such a defense that we should take the plea of guilty for what it is, and normally pleas of guilty waive all sorts of defenses that you might have had, pretty much everything. And the second thing is, sort of the next layer down, is there some reason to think that he might have been able to succeed with an insanity defense. And I gather there's a disagreement between you and your opponents about how far down this process we go, because they're saying if he had known enough, he at least would have stood on his right to a trial. You're taking another step further, if I understand you correctly, and saying, well, let's suppose we get that far. There wasn't enough here for him to win on an insanity defense, given his records and everything that we now know about how he was in 82. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, yes, that there was no prejudice as a result if we,
because you don't think
if we take everything as true now.
On an insanity defense?
No, I do not, personally.
But that, of course, isn't the standard. The standard under Strickland is our confidence in the outcome shaken by what went on.
Correct. I think, though, before I get into highlighting the facts underlying his guilty plea and his reasons for doing it, in conjunction with the reason why the insanity defense wouldn't have worked, is that I want to concentrate first on the mitigating factor, which states the murder was committed while the defendant was under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance, although not such as to constitute a defense to prosecution. So we can't say because counsel was ineffective at sentencing for failing to produce these documents, which the sentencing authority might consider as mitigating factors sufficient to preclude the imposition of the death penalty, and translate that, I think is what the petitioner is trying to do, into a viable insanity defense. It's simply not here. Dr. Stipes was a qualified, and is a qualified, mental health expert.
But how could you diagnose bipolar disorder without a full history of the patient, with an hour to talk to the patient?
Well, I think he talked to him twice, and then he talked to him in conjunction with a competency hearing also on whether he's competent to plead and be sentenced.
But I understand bipolar disorder is hard to diagnose without a full history.
Well, he did have the Illinois State Psychiatric Records.
Yeah.
He talked to the defendant about his life at the time of the crimes, what happened at the time of the crimes.
How long have you been in the penitentiary?
How long have I been?
Had he been in the penitentiary?
At that time?
I didn't think you had been there at all.
I visited it a couple of times.
You've been with this case a long time.
Since 1986.
I know.
He had been in the penitentiary, just got out 2 or 3 weeks before the murders.
And did Dr. Stipes have his Menard record?
He reviewed the transcript of Monty Williams. His
but
testimony
Monty Williams didn't have the records himself. With
he
him.
Didn't bring the records, but he talked about much of the history of Mr. St. Pierre. I think he also reviewed Father Smythe, the director at Maryville, who talked extensively, where Mr. St. Pierre was there for an extended period of time, about Mr. St. Pierre's history, his antisocial behavior, his status as a loner, and whatnot.
Being about to kill his mother, or whatever.
Well, he came from an alcoholic family, I know that, and I know Mr. Williams diagnosed a substance abuse, mixed alcohol and drug use and whatnot.
What are we to make of Judge Neville's wholesale rejection of the usefulness of Mr. Williams' testimony? Judge Neville thought it was ridiculous, I think.
Well, I think for purposes of the mitigating factor, that's what Mr. Williams testified to. He testified mitigation at the sentencing hearing.
And Judge Williams utterly disregarded it, said this is a joke, you don't even know what mitigating factors are, you're talking about the standards for civil commitment.
That's true, and also I think part of the deal was that Mr. Williams didn't bring any records with him to back up his opinion.
He said he was a combined psychologist, archaeologist, anthropologist?
Yes.
Okay. That may not have impressed Judge Neville.
having like archaeology myself, I would have been. But
Mr. Fitzgerald, is there anything in this record to indicate that Mr. Barassa, because of his former affiliation with the Defender Office, and I ask you this in part because of this unique decade and a half history you have with it, is there anything in the record to indicate that he communicated with either appellate counsel in the earlier cases or trial counsel?
In the record, I believe he says he did talk to the trial attorneys, at least, from the first trial. where insanity was not raised.
No,
another
I appreciate that. That's kind of the thrust of my question.
But I believe he said he did talk to some of the people involved in the first prosecution, that he knew either one of them or both of them that were defense counsel in the first trial. The extent of the conversations, I don't know.
No, I appreciate it. I obviously wouldn't ask you to speculate. But should that contact count at all? I'll obviously ask that of Mr. Warner. That in this setting?
I think it's a very real factor to consider. Review of the prior transcripts, talking with prior counsel on the case. Because here there is absolutely no indication on our record. And Judge Neville even says when he ordered the competency hearing, he says, I'm doing it because of the unique circumstances of this case. There's no outward manifestations by Mr. St. Pierre that calls his competency into question. Nothing he's done or said in this courtroom calls it into question. But because he gets reversed and he comes here and he tells me he wants to plead guilty right away over the protestations of his lawyer.
Well, and also all this business about wanting to leave Cook County Jail and go back to death row in Menard.
That was
Neville thought that was a little weird.
Well, he told me it was impossible to do it transportation-wise, you know, because he'd have to be present you know, for each day in court. But that was the sole reason, and that's a factor that Dr. Stipes also considered in determining his competency to plead and to be sentenced. Was his sole concern about the homosexuality, the gangs, and the uncomfortable way he felt in Cook County Jail? And the judge told him point blank, I will not accept your plea if that is the sole reason for it. And the next day, you know, after accepting the plea, after, over a two-day period with extensive questioning about his knowledge of waiving his rights, Mr. St. Pierre never hesitated. There's absolutely nothing here that would call his sanity at the time of the murders into question.
Certainly not, and I guess that's why we're not pursuing sanity at the time of the guilty plea. I don't know about sanity at the time of the murders, and I don't know how we get there here other than via, I guess it must be the state of Illinois' position that depriving somebody of the right to a trial isn't because they aren't informed. I mean, suppose somebody wanted to plead guilty and the lawyer never told the person that there was a complete defense to the crime, so the person pleads guilty. Not insanity, which I know is a different thing. Suppose in a different situation, a hypothetical statute, there's a complete defense to the crime. Maybe the date you committed it was before the statute was passed or something simple like that. The lawyer never tells the person, and the person pleads guilty.
Well, here I think...
You don't see any prejudice to that? The lack of information?
If that were the case here...
No, don't jump. There's a couple of cases like that. So.
Well, these are hypothetical, and I'm just trying to figure out, first of all, the theories that we have before us. Secondly, maybe you can elucidate this statement in Judge Koukouras' opinion that I asked Mr. Warner about, where he says the possibility of an insanity defense was raised and discussed. That makes a difference to me if that happened or if it didn't happen, and when it happened.
I believe in the deposition that was taken a year or so ago, Mr. Barassa, he stated that it was at least considered. The extent of the discussions with St. Pierre were never delved into. How far did he go with it?
And did the record show when these discussions took place?
Well, Mr. Barassa was appointed to this case, and I think it was the first court date that they showed up on. Mr. St. Pierre walks in and says, I want to plead guilty.
Well, isn't that where Judge Neville says, like 2 days later, when St. Pierre is saying, and I don't even want a mitigation hearing, Judge Neville says, hold your horses, 2 days from the very beginning all the way to a death hearing is the fastest I've ever seen, or words
correct
to that effect.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So it was, when you combine St. Pierre's obstinacy, as Judge Koukouras correctly termed it, with the fact that counsel did confer with prior counsel, that there was no evidence of insanity. He obviously talked to Father Smythe. He put him on. He read the transcript of the prior trial. He put on Monty Williams. He did all he could under the circumstances. The fact that Dr. Hemrick now comes in, pronouncing his name correctly, several years later, his review is flawed. He omitted many things. He didn't read the transcripts of this case. He didn't know the facts of this case. He didn't know how Mr. St. Pierre savagely beat these two people over a 30-minute period of time. How he planned this. That's not the actions of an insane man.
Well, but I guess the question in part would go to what bipolar does to people, because impulse controls, I understand, is a big part of that. But isn't the question whether, if this had been looked into, there would have been a fuller picture of St. Pierre's mental state before he pleaded guilty?
No, I think that what we have to do is try and do away with hindsight, you know, under Strickland, because this is an ineffective assistance claim.
Well,
and what did counsel know at the time?
Go ahead.
And did he do what was constitutionally required of him with the knowledge he had at that particular point in time? Dr. Kelly, who testified at the state clerical proceeding, also found a bipolar disorder. And so did the other doctors. But none of them went as far as to say he was insane at the time. And I think that Dr. Kelly's review, and there was a conclusion, and it was joined in by Judge Neville and obviously Judge Koukouras, why St. Pierre suffered from a psychotic disorder. There was no evidence of psychosis, and the disorder did not interfere with the petitioner's ability to make rational decisions. Now, that went to the question of, was he able to way further state court proceedings. But I think it's very telling that he did not suffer from this bipolar on a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week basis. That it came and went, I think, was the diagnosis of most of the doctors. And he wasn't always acting under it. And the fact, when you look at the actions that this man performed in planning this murder and carrying it out and then bragging about it afterwards and helping to clean up the murder scene, all for a few measly dollars, that's not an insane mind. Those actions are the product of a cold and calculating mind of a man who wanted money. He might have wanted to impress his co-defendants, but that doesn't make him insane. So there is no evidence whatsoever at the time of the pleas, at the time of the crime, that this man was insane and that an insanity defense would have worked.
But isn't the argument you need to make, and maybe, I mean, I think you are making it, in fact, is that even if Barassa's performance had been exemplary, he couldn't have come up with, the, as Judge Bauer put it, the quote, some evidence that would have been enough of a production to switch the burden to the state, as you were just reading, in 1982, would have happened to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. You're saying that the some evidence was not going to be there, no matter what.
We submit that's correct, Your Honor. Yes, most definitely. In my opponent's brief, they did talk about, you know, the crime of murder, and one of the themes common in throughout their brief is that somehow insanity is an element of the offense of murder. It's never been the law in Illinois, certainly not now, not in 1982. It was an affirmative defense. The state did. Doesn't go in and prove everybody's sane. The law presumes people to be sane, unless there is some evidence which raises it, either through the state's case or the defendant's case, or prior to trial, if the judge finds some sort of bona fide doubt.
Right, but I think you guys are really, in fact, both saying the same thing here. This is all about whether that initial showing on St. Pierre's part was enough to switch the burden then to the state to prove by a higher standard than you'd have to do. I mean, you don't even have the burden anymore. The burden then, though, was on the state.
And it would stay on us.
Make a difference, right?
It would stay with us because if he's charged according to 1982.
Sure, no, but I mean if a new person did something horrendous today, it would be a different situation.
Yes.
Right.
He was competent to plead guilty. As the brief points out, as I said earlier, the judge went through extensive detail and questioning of Mr. St. Pierre to ascertain that he was pleading guilty because he did, in fact, commit these crimes.
Is that also the same thing as saying he's criminally responsible?
No, I'm talking about.
He's admitting that he did these things. He admitted the charges. But he doesn't know at the time he pleads guilty, as far as we can tell, that he might not be criminally responsible for them.
He knew he was criminally responsible. There's no evidence of insanity in this case. The findings and the records that were brought forward years later do not establish insanity. It might be a troubled mind. Maybe sane people don't understand why St. Pierre did what he did, but he did it as a result of his own volition. Nobody placed that hammer in his hand. Nobody else hit these people in the head with the hammer. He did that alone. No accomplices at that point in time. He recalled in chilling detail what he felt like, you know, to his attorney, and Mr. Barassa describes that, and that's in our brief, about the adrenaline rush he got after he killed, you know, Mr. Gibbons, and waiting for Mrs. Gibbons to come home with her daughter, who went to pick her up at the Elves. And the adrenaline was so great, he couldn't wait for her to get in. He almost blew the plan because he did it right in the doorway. The plan was to let her get into the house and nobody would see them.
That does sound like somebody who has no impulse control at that moment.
Well, I think it's more adrenaline.
Well, I mean, it could be. Bipolar is lack of impulse control when you're in the manic half, but anyway.
But it certainly is not sufficient under the state of Illinois, the law in the state of Illinois, to raise an insanity defense. Time and again, Mr. St. Pierre has shown his sophistication since the first time in the trial. I believe in the first argument, Judge Wood, you commented that, you know, he started changing his mind and flip-flopping from the very beginning, from the time of his arrest.
Right.
He knows what he's doing. He knew what he was doing in 1982. He knows what he's doing now. He was sane at that time. He pled guilty against the advice of counsel. And his only reason for doing it was the problems in county jail. That's what he said. And the judge says, I'm not taking it. That's your only reason. You got to tell me. And then he told the judge, now for me to plead not guilty would be tantamount to getting away with murder. And that's not my intention. And he pled guilty. So for all these reasons, as well as those expressed in our brief, we request that the district court order be affirmed in this respect. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. Mr. Warner?
I'd just like to respond to a few of the points that the state has raised in argument. One, I think there may be a little bit of confusion over our arguments with respect to what constituted deficient performance on the part of Mr. Barassa. It's our position that his deficiencies, to the extent that it constituted essentially no investigation at all, regardless of whether that was an investigation with respect to a possible mitigating factor or the possible defense of insanity, is essentially the same. Mr. Barassa knew that he had an obligation to raise the issue of insanity. He filed two motions, but he never raised it to a point that was sufficient. He only presented the evidence of a completely incompetent witness on that point, on the issue of whether Mr. St. Pierre was sane at the time of the offenses. And I think
this is the hearing where Mr. Barassa says, I'm really unprepared for this?
Yes, that was the September 12th hearing. And that was on the first motion to determine Mr. St. Pierre's sanity. He admits to being unprepared. Judge Neville reminds him that it's his obligation to raise this to a level that's worthy of further consideration. And even when Mr. Barassa came back and filed a second motion to have Mr. St. Pierre's sanity determined at the time of the offense, he still hadn't done anything. He hadn't uncovered the records. He hadn't consulted with an independent mental health expert. And again, Judge Neville was left with no option but to again reject Mr. Williams' testimony. With respect to whether there's some evidence in this case.
But how do we know that part relates in Judge Neville's mind to the validity of the guilty plea as opposed to the potential usefulness of this evidence in mitigation? Because you both agreed that there's a distinction between those two phases.
Yes, I think that's made plain by the fact that Judge Neville was ruling on a motion to withdraw Mr. St. Pierre's guilty plea. And what he wanted to do was have Mr. St. Pierre examined for sanity and further support of that motion to withdraw the guilty plea. So I think there is some bleeding over because the guilty plea happened so quickly and they moved on to the next stage of sentencing, but at that time, at the beginning of the sentencing hearing on September 12th, Mr. Barasa presented this motion to withdraw Mr. St. Pierre's guilty plea, and that was based in part on his belief that there was some issue with respect to Mr. St. Pierre's sanity. The problem was he just never investigated it adequately, and he never presented the motion adequately, and as a result, it was denied.
So you would say this is clearly not a case where nobody has any idea that a sanity problem is on the table, at least as of the motion to withdraw in the September 12th hearing.
That's right, and even before that, I would say, based on the suicide attempt and the fact that the trial courts and Mr. Barasa's interest was piqued, they were surprised that he had showed up and decided to enter into a...
But Mr. Warner, doesn't that speak to the competency issue? To plead, not to the insanity issue?
I think it may go to both.
Well, I suppose anything in life's history can relate back to in time, but should Mr. Barasa accepting this assignment have presumed, based on the investigation you suggest he needed to have, that Mr. St. Pierre had incompetent counsel, ineffective counsel at the first trial?
That's not our position.
Well, what would be your professional assessment in light of what you're saying Mr. Barasa's shortcomings are? Would you suggest that counsel closer in time who defended him had shortcomings?
I think the standard is whether or not there were objectively available signs that trial counsel should have looked into the issue of insanity. I think that's the standard under Jones v. Page in the Franzen case, and I think I'm not exactly sure what the record reflected with respect to the first trial, but with respect to the second trial, when he showed up and decided that expressed an intention to plead guilty, enter a blind plea of guilty, and Mr. Barasa knew about the suicide attempt and had a discussion with Mr. Williams, during which Mr. Williams expressed his opinion that there is a probability that Mr. St. Pierre was insane at the time of the crimes, that those factors certainly led Mr. Barasa to, should have led Mr. Barasa to pursue an investigation of the insanity issue.
We should say Mr. Barasa should give some weight to Mr. Williams, but Judge Neville, we should support in his assessment of Mr. Williams?
My position is that that Judge Neville was absolutely right in rejecting Mr. Williams' testimony. He had never testified on the issue of sanity before. At a minimum, the fact that Mr. Barasa's investigation terminated after Mr. Williams, that's unreasonable. It should have triggered him to consult with a qualified mental health expert such as Dr. Hemrick. And in terms of what the sum evidence is, I think Hemrick's opinion and the fact that three psychiatrists have since diagnosed Mr. St. Pierre with bipolar disorder, at a minimum, is sufficient to meet our burden in this case. I would respectfully request that the court reversed the district court's findings with respect to Mr. St. Pierre's ineffective assistance claim and the invalidity of the guilty plea.
All right. Thank you. And Mr. Warner, I want to thank you and co-counsel Mr. Stein for your most able representation. And Mr. Fitzgerald, I want to thank you for not only your tenure, but your able representation of the state in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, the case is taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess.